Hello and welcome. My name is Jo Frost and here with my co-host Peter Linus, this is Being Human. Afternoon.
Well, yes, good day. How are you?
I'm sulking.
Because there's no sunshine.
I know I am the most British person in the world ever, but I love talking about the weather. I hate talking about the weather. I'm so upset. It's gone back to November again.
Well, it's a rare moment when you should move out of London and come to Northern Ireland where it is definitely a balmy, 13, 14 degrees, beautifully still. The sun is just about getting through. So,
no.
Today is the day, one day. You should come to be around.
Because I used to live in South France, as you know, but listeners may not. And I do actually continue to torture myself by having saved the weather forecast of where we used to live. So I can see just how much I'm suffering for Jesus right now by being in London and not in the South of France.
That is a whole other episode of your theology of suffering for Jesus by being in London. But we'll maybe pass on that. Yes, but I don't know why you do it to yourself. Don't.
I just want to be warm. All right. So anyway, that's not what we're here to discuss today. So what are we talking about today, Peter?
We are talking about the limits on life. Are there limits on life? The boundaries of life, the threshold spaces, entry into life and exiting from life. So if you want to just be blunt about what that means in terms of the kind of public policy media debate, that is abortion and euthanasia are the two big topics that often drive that conversation.
Right. Yes, because being human at its most simplistic level is about being literally alive. And yet how and when life starts and how and when life ends are hugely contested areas of public debate. So today, as with all episodes in this season, we're going to use the Being Human lens to help guide and shape our exploration of being human and being alive. Once again, we'd like to remind you, please do get in touch with us if you've got any questions or comments about some of the topics that we're covering this season, or anything you would like us to cover. You can email us at beinghuman@eauk.org. You can get in touch with us on social media, but also please do remember to like, rate or subscribe. We're now on YouTube as well as your favourite podcast platform. So please get in touch, follow us, connect with us wherever you can. We would love to hear from you.
Right. So we're on massive topics, the beginning of life, the end of life, the boundaries of life. And these are massive issues in the UK. They are massive issues globally. It was a program on, I think it was about 6 months ago now, it was Prue Leith of the Bake Off fame, Prue with the wonderful glasses and matching outfits. So, and her son is Danny Kruger, who's a Conservative MP, and they did a little program together. Prue Leith, who must be in her 80s, I would say, by now. She doesn't look it, but she's actually quite old. She is, you can Google it. I think she's just turned 80 or thereabout. Right, Joe was definitely Googling now while I say that. She is in favor of assisted suicide, assisted dying. Even the language is contested here, so I would call it assisted suicide. And she wants law change to allow that to happen more easily in the UK. Danny Kruger, her son, the MP, is against that. I think that's an unhealthy idea. And so they went off to Canada together to see what's happening there, something we will return to shortly. And Jo would now chip in, but she's so busy Googling to find out that Prue Leith is in fact 81 or something, isn't she?
84.
Unbelievable.
What?
Yes.
May I want her face?
See,
that's
we do.
Amazing.
We do fact checked every episode, even if it's live on
no,
the show.
No, we don't.
We fact check it live. We fact check each other. That's the only reason anything is accurate on this show, because we usually don't believe the other person. So with that, and Sally Phillips, the comedian, I think she might have done a show, A World Without Downs, but she certainly has commented a lot on her own son. Comedies.
She's big in the campaign, Don't Screen Us Out. So
yes.
Campaigning against legislation, proposed changes around whether or not you can screen for and then have terminations based on the likelihood of your unborn baby having Down syndrome.
Yeah, and she's done like the morning shows. I think she has done a specific program on it. Her son, Ollie, she's talked to her son who's 14 now, who has Downs. And she talks about the reality of what that legislation and would allow us to happen. And in fact, what happens in other countries, and we'll come on to that more, but I mean, essentially they are screened out. Iceland has literally one or two Downs babies a year born now because their screening program is so comprehensive, stroke, totalitarian, stroke, problematic. You could put a lot of words in there, but fundamentally, there are virtually no Downs babies in Iceland, Denmark, similar number of the Nordic countries taking that approach. So huge issues.
And very light. We are hearing more and more chatter about proposed legislation coming through both Westminster and some of the devolved governments within the UK, Scotland probably being the biggest, especially around end of life and assisted dying legislation. So this is coming. It's absolutely right at the forefront of so many political and societal debates.
And whether we like it or not, the American election is going to have a huge thing around abortion, and the American election has a big impact everywhere, whether we like it or not. It's just the reality. So that's definitely where we're going to hear more about it as
Indeed. Well. Okay. So reminder, the Being Human Lens is a tool which we use to explore contested and cultural issues and storylines to help us understand who we are and how we can live in the world around us. It helps us explore the stories that we're immersed in, as well as the God story that invites us to live truly, fully human lives in Jesus. So around the lens, we experience significance. You matter, who matters. This is where we explore issues around equality, dignity, and identity. We go to connection. This is where we see that we matter to each other. No man is an island, but we are interconnected. So this is our space for relationships, for justice, and for peace, as we explore how we are connected to each other, to God, and to the world around us. We then land in presence. Being here now matters, recognizing that we are physical, cultural, and temporal human beings. We live in a place, in a time, and in a season. And then finally, into participation. The difference that we make in the world matters. This is where we explore our power, our purpose, our freedom. So we're going to put beginning and end of life in our focal point and explore around these four core aspects of what it means to be human and ask, does the God story and does the king of that God story, Jesus, invite us into a better story to live and to be in the world? Peter, significance, kick us off.
And significance is probably something, you know, last week we shifted things around and pulled presence forward. Significance is probably the primary aspect in this conversation. Not exclusive, but it really drives it. We might spend a few minutes longer here because it really goes to the ultimate question of whose life matters, who gets to live, both who gets to be born, if you like, and then when it comes to the end of life, depending on the legislation and the countries we're in, who gets to die or to choose their own death or to have somebody facilitate their death. So it massive questions on dignity and the very right to exist, to be alive. So two massive aspects. For me, abortion, the first one, the beginning of that conversation, has a huge question on essentially the right to be alive. And then the disability question comes in behind that really quickly, because within the UK where we are, legislation allows a different treatment for a baby who's been diagnosed with a disability. And essentially those babies are allowed to be aborted after the 24-week limit. So laws in the UK varying a bit, but largely speaking, we have a 24-week limit. You can have an abortion up to 24 weeks if two doctors agree with that. The reality is that 98% of abortions involve physically healthy mother and a physically healthy baby. After that 24 weeks, you can only have an exceptional grounds. I think it's ground E. And that's where there's a disability. But there are a significant number of babies every year. 3,500 babies go under that ground. And that would include lots of babies with Down syndrome. So 74% of parents who found out their baby had Down syndrome decided to abort in the UK. And the scale in the UK is 214,000. I think in the last year, just over 200,000 abortions a year carried out in the UK.
Now, not in our notes, but I want to ask the question anyway. In Northern Ireland, you did have some of the most restrictive legislation on abortion. And now you have, I think I'm right in thinking, some of the most permissive legislation, at least in Europe. Do you want to talk through a little bit about what changed and what impact that's had?
Yes, you've given away that we sometimes have notes and that definitely now don't in this bit, but you're right. So the 1967 Abortion Act that permitted abortion in the UK didn't apply in Northern Ireland. So essentially the only grounds there were the threat to the life and health of the mother, and that threat had to be imminent and severe. And so that was a fairly rare ground in Northern Ireland. I think the numbers were short of 40 to 50 abortions a year that might have hit that threshold. In reality, very, very few abortions. You had a small number of people who travelled. And then we saw a massive change in the law. And it's worth saying again, for people who are based in the UK, the 24 weeks feels normal. That's our cultural kind of norm in large parts of the UK. 12 weeks is almost the standard across Europe. We actually in the UK have some of the most liberal, permissive. Again, we realize language is hugely loaded on this, but I'm not trying to, but we have some of the most extreme, I would say, laws on this in terms of the limits of where that's going in 24 weeks. So Northern Ireland then adopted that. It's 24 weeks for essentially no reason. And actually it's much easier to go beyond that too, right up to birth. So we saw a massive shift. And one of the big things for us is how you frame engagement in this. And one of the things we were able to say, instead of constantly saying, I think it's now close to 9 million babies have been terminated under the 67 Act. That is true. And it's an overwhelming stat that I can't comprehend. We slightly switched that and said, well, then how many are alive in Northern Ireland? Because we didn't follow the same law. And we take account of those who've traveled. We take account of other things. We said there are 100,000 babies or people alive in Northern Ireland who wouldn't otherwise have been. Because law impacts culture, culture impacts law. And even if you, once you allow it, more people will use that permissible route. And so we were saying, the reality is there are 100,000 people alive. That's a fundamental significance question, if you like, is that is just statistically true. And if you allow me a moment on a tangent, we got challenged for an advert we ran around that. And somebody said, you can't say that because it's not true. And in the process, the advertising standards agency told us to take it down until we could verify it. We actually showed them the research and they essentially accepted. They went off and got an external person to do the analysis on this and everything. So we now have a robust figure that we can say has been externally checked and that 100,000 is a verifiable number. So in a strange way, it was a phenomenal moment where one small billboard became a huge news story. And again, it was we'll come back to that in participation maybe, but a wonderful way, I think, to positively frame engagement in what is a very difficult conversation.
Yeah, because at the core of the abortion conversation, and we'll get to euthanasia in a second, at the core of the abortion conversation is, do I have autonomy as a woman over my own body? Does anybody else have a say? Is the act of terminating a pregnancy healthcare? Or are there more fundamental human rights involved in it? Is it my body, my choice? Is it an autonomy? Is it a feminist issue? Is this something to be celebrated as the dignity of women are affirmed in this? Or is it something to be lamented as the equality of human life is diminished or challenged depending on where you sit in this conversation?
Yes, and it does seem a real shame that it's been framed by our culture at large that freedom requires this to be fully female, in particular in this, on the abortion issue, requires the ability to terminate a pregnancy. And to be fully human in the wider euthanasia conversation requires the right to have a doctor end my life at the time of my choosing, that these are considered rights and necessary liberties or freedoms. To be fully human by our culture. And I think both are deeply problematic.
So let's move in then to euthanasia. We at the moment in the UK, I don't believe we have any permitted spaces where assisted dying is legal, but there are increasing number of countries around the world where assisted dying, assisted suicide or euthanasia is legal. Why do you think this is becoming such a hot topic at the moment, Peter? And what do you think is in play as we talk about significant?
So I do think it goes to the individual freedom, people's framing around dignity. And again, my right to do as I choose, my right to end my life when it suits me. And I'm not trying to say that kind of dismissively. And the language becomes incredibly important, as you've just noted there. Physician assisted suicide, I think would be the phrase. You know, it is a doctor or a medical professional doing that, but it is assisted suicide. It is the ending of your own life, but having somebody else do it. It's not dying in the natural sense of that, but it is a control thing. It's like, I want to control the level of suffering in my life. I want to control when this ends. I want to be in charge, and I want to kind of preclude potentially when my faculties aren't sufficiently alert to be able to make those decisions myself. So you have living wills when people make decisions. We'll come to in a minute what's happening in Canada, because I think it also pushes into our ability to resource and do dying well. You know, a good death is something that I think we should be able to talk about and have good conversations about. But fear around that and the costs involved in that are also driving some of this conversation, I think. So control is right at the heart of that, and fear around death, I would say. But I'd love, curious to hear what you think on that too.
Yeah, I suppose for me, when we get to significance, I probably want to tap into the conversation around the idea of dignity and the indignity of a bad death, when pain and suffering and the quality of one's life diminishes. We are, as a society, really uncomfortable with death. We ignore it, we shove it away, we don't really want to think about it, but we certainly don't want the indignity of a prolonged, maybe, but certainly a painful death. And so I think there's a huge amount of compassion attached to the narrative of euthanasia and assisted dying. When we look at somebody's pain and suffering, we as a society want to eradicate that. And I think there's something really good and positive in that. But I also, I suppose I want to get to the point of saying, actually, there is dignity in life in and of itself, that we are image bearers of the author and sustainer of life. And therefore death is the antithesis of that. It is completely counter to our being. And therefore to hurry death, both in ourselves and in others, I think there's something kind of profoundly unsettling about that as a narrative that we want to pursue, rather than asking the question, where is the dignity in dying well, but recognizing the finite and fragile nature of what it is to be human and what it is to be alive. So I really sympathize with the motivation behind it, but arguably with both of these storylines, where I struggle is the solution being proposed. So whilst I understand why, and we'll get into this in a minute with abortion, I understand the motivation for a pregnant woman in crisis to have an abortion, I don't think abortion is the solution. And similarly, at the end of life, I get the motivation to want to die with dignity and have the control over when that happens. I'm not convinced that euthanasia is the solution for that. I think there is a better way.
Absolutely. So as you said, we're coming to connection in a minute, and I think you've begun to answer. We always ask, what's the better story around this? And I actually was checking out something and stumbled onto the BBC website, Christians and Euthanasia, under their RE section. They often have their ethics thing. And actually, it was a really healthy and helpful summary, because sometimes the BBC gets a lot of criticism. Like, why it says Christians are mostly against euthanasia because life is a gift from God, because human beings are valuable, as you were saying, and made in the image of God, because the process of dying is spiritually important and should not be disrupted, because all lives are equally valuable. So regardless of our ability to contribute to society at that point, mobility, intelligence, any of those issues, again, that goes to our significance and equality. It says, regardless of any of those, we're all equal. You know, and then it talks about the importance of end-of-life care and how Christian faith has strong views on how that needs to be good, community-orientated palliative care with honesty and support as we face dying. So as long as I was like, that's a very good summary, actually, of a better story around this. And we should have that on both issues, and they're a bit contested. And I do think we need to be really careful to do a good job to articulate why we're so passionate about them, and then do that really positively and in a winsome way, rather than we sometimes come in a bit hard and say, well, here's the answer and here's why you're wrong. And that probably does naturally take us to connection because it's one of the ways in which we engage in this space.
I think the one thing I would love to end when it comes to this conversation around significance and life in and of itself, being spiritually important and death in and of itself having spiritual significance, is I suppose I fundamentally don't believe there is such a thing as a good death. And I think our desire to fix the problem of dying is a fundamental longing within each of us that death was never part of the design. It was never part of our story. It is not good. Death is the consequence of the fall. And so we rage against it and we rage against the injustice of it and we want to wrestle control back over it. But I think for me, ultimately, we have to tell a story of hope that goes beyond the grave. And I suppose the question of quality and purpose of life, if those things are so diminished that we say it is better for you not to be alive at all, then we are ultimately offering a fundamentally hopeless story. And I think in Jesus, there is always hope. Hope wins. Our story has a good and beautiful conclusion. And so I think recognizing the futility of a good death, but knowing that in Jesus there is always hope, is a fundamentally important storyline when it comes to significance. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to look at the idea of connection, that we matter to each other. And how does how we start and how we end life affect our relationships with each other, with God, and in the world? Okay, welcome back. We are in the second aspect of connection. We're looking at the beginning and end of life and how that affects our being human in and of this world. How does abortion and euthanasia interact in the aspect of connection, Peter?
Well, I guess both are a push for freedom in their various ways, but the reason they're challenging is because of the connection, be it with the unborn child, the physical connection for the mother and the father, and we want to talk about those connections, or for the person who wants to end their life. One, they require a doctor, but there is always a family in some shape or form. There are a series of connections, and any decision we take impacts another person. And it may have been impacted, or we may feel we've been driven to decision because of the actions of others as well. So these are highly interconnected decision-making moments in our lives, and they absolutely reflect the reality of the fact that we are relational beings at our core.
And I think a lot of the political conversations I've seen want to diminish that interconnected aspect of the conversation. So it is a woman's right to choose. It is a woman's right to have autonomy over her body. The father doesn't get to say, the unborn child doesn't get to say, society doesn't get to say, politicians don't get to have a say. It is ultimately an individual's choice over an individual body. And I think that's probably, at least around the abortion conversation, the bit that we want to really kind of push around a little bit and ask, is that true? And is that a good way to live and to operate? Because actually, no human life has unfettered autonomy over another. And whatever somebody decides to do, whatever a woman may choose to do with her body and a pregnancy, it cannot be true that that is an isolated decision made at an individual level. There are always other lives affected by that choice.
Yes. So I think we're moving off script. It's always risky. Let's see. So I'm going to ask you a little bit about the abortion question, and then maybe I'll speak a little bit about the euthanasia question and those connections. Because while I reject the premise that a man doesn't have a voice in this conversation, we have to acknowledge it's a different voice. And one of the things we want to say is they should be absolutely connected into it. But I think it is really helpful to hear, because you've been talking to quite a number of people who've journeyed this. So that connection part around abortion and how you wrestle with that.
Yeah, I think it is really interesting, at least in my space. So a lot of the women that I talk to, especially outside of the church, would presume that in order to be a intelligent feminist, progressive woman of the world, I must have a pro-choice worldview. So I'm often in conversations where people assume my perspective is a shared perspective with the kind of prevailing female narrative that is out there. But when you cut behind it and get behind some of those statements around, I'm allowed to do what I like with my body, and it wasn't a right time for me, and I'm really glad that I made that decision because my life is better now. Instead of pitting the political against the individual, because that's often how it feels, a woman versus the political man telling what a woman needs to do with her body. I actually use a quote by Karen Swallow Pryor quite a lot. So, friend of the show. She wrote in the New York Times a few years ago when Roe v. Wade was overturned by the Supreme Court. She wrote an article next day. And in it, she said, "I lament of the impoverishment of a social imagination that cannot conceive of a world in which women can flourish without abortion." And so when I raise that as a question, what is it about abortion that is solving the problem for women and their freedom? It raises up a whole different conversation, because abortion is the course correction of an injustice against women. So women were bound to the home, they were bound to the family, they were bound to domestic life. And the only way that they can use their intellect or their creativity or become economic forces within a society is to rid them of the obligations of the familial and the domestic. So this course correction of the injustice of trapping women in the home is only made possible, the argument goes, by having access to abortion. But it doesn't achieve that justice. It simply perpetuates it in new and different directions. So instead of women being trapped in the home, instead they're trapped in their shame, they're trapped in the individual responsibility of what it is to terminate another life, to end a pregnancy. The physical and mental and emotional and spiritual impact of that is still being carried by women today. And actually, if you can have that conversation, you're having a very different dialogue into the space that says, is abortion the pinnacle of the justice for women, or is it perpetuating further injustices just in new forms?
Absolutely. And look, we could go back and forth on this, but I suppose I'm going to jump to the euthanasia question and the MAID legislation in Canada. So Canada passed probably the most liberal laws around this, and it started off that they had to be imminently and reasonably foreseeable. You're basically 6 months out from death. Then classically, of course, a court case was taken saying that discriminated against people who were further out than that, and so it was ruled to be unconstitutional, and so they've extended the law, and now it just has to be a chronic illness, and now they've added mental health. Now that doesn't come into play, I think, until 2027, but they have passed the legislation. So mental illness will then be included. And as one of the key physicians said, what this tells me, what the growth in this in Canada says, is that Canada has paid the most attention to individual human rights and autonomy. So, well, actually, we probably agree on that, myself and that physician. I'm not sure that's a good thing. And in fact, I'm very sure it's not a good thing, the growth, because what has ended up happening is 40,000 people have gone through this legislation. It'll be more now. That was the last set of figures. 4.1% of all deaths in Canada are now physician-assisted suicide. It rises to something like 7% in a place, Victoria, on the island of Vancouver Island, just because of the elderly population. So this has grown fairly significantly, 4%. I mean, that is a staggering amount. And again, it's that individual autonomy is what's driving it. But the figures coming out of Canada are beginning to tell us, and people are telling their story. They're saying, I can't afford the healthcare I am a burden to my family. I'm a burden to the state and the resources. I don't have the resources to pay for any kind of decent care here. And so people are saying because of poverty, because of family pressures, because of the cost of healthcare, those are the reasons. It's not individual freedom and autonomy in many cases. It's the pressures and the realities of relationships, which have both positive and negative effects. So because nobody's there to care for them. And we talk about a slippery slope argument, but it's absolutely the case. One of the biggest concerns for everybody is we're not able to provide sufficient care right now. And so people are making what I think are bad choices based on an autonomy. And they're ignoring the impact that has on many other people and relationships. And it's subtle and it's hard to quantify, because if you're elderly and you know that the money you hope to pass on to your kids, that the resources that they had and your grandkids and other things, and you're using them up, and not just that money, but some of their money, and you're acquiring their care, you can feel the pressure if there's another way out. We need to reorientate that conversation again, that the solution, similar to abortion, is not to end my life and have somebody else end my life. There have to be better ways of having this conversation. Difficult as that is, and there are consequences to that, consequences for all of us. It's not just money, as we'll come to in a minute. We're going to have to show up and be present in some of these conversations. Yeah.
I think it's absolutely fascinating if you tie some of these storylines together, that we have a lowering birth rate. So there is a decreasing population being born, at least in the West. So less babies. Then you have a workforce that is increasingly not working because of mental health especially, but health challenges. So you have underemployment in the workforce and you have an aging population. All of these things are going to put societal and primarily economic pressure on the elderly and the older as time goes on. So one of the most pragmatic solutions will be to shorten the lifespan of the elderly so that we can rebalance the population as a diminishing younger generation fails to emerge, arguably. That's an argument that was being put forward a couple of weeks ago in different articles, and it sits really uncomfortably when you see it in such stark form to say, well, we need the older generation to die quicker because we haven't got a younger generation coming up quickly enough to counterbalance it. But they're some of the societal conversations that we are having, but we're just having them at a really insidious level, where this is being proposed as a good and beneficial storyline for us to live in. But actually asking the question, where is this coming from and what's driving this, may reveal to us source of skepticism and doubt around whether or not these stories are quite as good as they're being presented to be.
Yes, absolutely. So connection, we have wrestled with connection. You know, the church has often told a better story in this space and has tried to do its best in this, but this goes right back to the early church and your friend. I'm going to let you say his name.
I even Googled it to pronounce it right and I'm still going to butcher it. Diognetus, let's go with him. It's a letter from an early church father and it's long and it's brilliant, but the little quote, when he's asked, what are Christians like and how do they live? He writes, they marry, as do all others. They beget children, but they do not destroy their offspring. They have a common table, but not a common bed. They are in the flesh, but they do not live after the flesh. They pass their days on earth, but they are citizens of heaven. What a beautiful picture it is of a community of people following after Jesus and trying to live a better story in the world that we inhabit.
And just to be absolutely clear on this, the early church were known, and we have a number of historical sources, for going and lifting babies that were what they called discarded. So often females, because people then didn't want that in terms of an heir within the house or a responsibility or burden. So they literally took a newborn baby, set them outside the city walls and discarded them on the rubbish tips. And the early Christians were known and almost kind of condemned. It was almost like, what are these weirdos doing? They went and lifted those babies that were not their own, took them into their houses and raised them as their own. And that's what they became famous in some ways for. And that's what he's referring to a little bit here, just to absolutely kind of put the flesh on the bones around that conversation. So it's a wonderful, better story that we're telling. Okay, so we've looked at significance, we've looked at connection. and we've gone long on those undoubtedly. So we're going to pull this in with presence, because euthanasia and abortion are very much about the embodied moment. They're about bodies and about the limits of life. Our lives are finite. They're time limited. Do we have the power to limit our lives, anybody else's lives? Like, and they're also about who shows up in the conversation, because if we're going to resolve these issues, we're going to engage with them, we're going to have to be present in very real and costly ways in the conversation. So help us unpack presence a little more.
Well, I think that conversation question is really interesting, because the connection has driven us apart and said that the woman needs to make the decision for herself, or the person at the entering end of life care, they need to make the decision for themselves. Nobody can influence and nobody can coerce or corrupt or manipulate in any way. What we've done is we've isolated people and we've said, well, you need to decide for yourself. And that carries a burden that's actually really, it's too heavy for most of us. So our showing up, our being present, our sitting alongside, our lamenting in the dust, those things are absolutely critical. I think for me, euthanasia is probably the interesting space for me around presence. My great uncle was a pioneer of the hospice movement. He worked with Dame Cicely Saunders, who was a Christian who basically invented palliative care in the UK. And he took it over into Africa and into Australia. But she was fascinating when it came to dignity at the end of one's life, but also asking that question, is there such a thing as quality of life? And what happens when that ends? And so she said what motivated her and kind of set her kind of philosophy on how she handled palliative care. She said, it appears many patients feel deserted by their doctors in the end. Ideally, the doctor should remain at the center of a team who work together to relieve where they cannot heal, and to keep the patient's own struggle within his compass, and to bring hope and consolation to the end. And I think that's the point, that we can be present to people making huge life and death decisions and being asked to carry the burden of those decisions. We can be present to them. We can sit alongside them. We can support them. We can carry them. We can offer them consolation where there may not necessarily be healing, but we can always affirm dignity and we can always journey with people, being present to them as they do it.
Yeah, and often in presence, we talk about being present in a postmodern world, a world that is deconstructed. And in the abortion conversation, you see that it's a fetus, the language, and then suddenly it's a royal baby. And you're like, but it was a fetus a few weeks ago in some other conversation, and it's a collection of cells. And at the end of life, there's no purpose left. There's no life left in this person. They're ready for death. You know, so we want to kind of deconstruct some of the kind of both the morals around that and just the personhood, in a sense, in the conversation, and then get rid of the existing norms and say what the new normal is in these conversations, because the alternative is incredibly costly to do. Like, if you've had a dying relative, it's not a lot of fun. It's not very interesting to be lifting and laying and wiping bottoms. Here's the reality of that, and feeding people, and it's hard work, and it's costly in terms of time and resource and energy. It is not particularly life-giving in some of those seasons. It's hard. Let's just acknowledge the difficulty of doing the kind of thing that we're talking, because if you don't agree with euthanasia and ending those lives, then we've got to pick up the pieces that are around that. And it's suffering, and we don't like the word suffering. It's suffering for the person and often for those around. But we absolutely believe that we don't get to control the moment of death, and there is character built in suffering, and it's one of the things we have to do. But it is a struggle, and I think we need to say, yeah, it is really costly to live near your parents or to make some decisions around that, to raise kids with significant disabilities and to go through that. Some of those are incredibly difficult, and it's wonderful and it's rewarding, and there are communities who gather around, but let's not deny the difficulty and the suffering in that. But I think we have tried to move to a world which just eliminates all suffering at every level and every sort, and I don't think that is the solution.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the costliness of life and of death are significant things, and even just this conversation will stir up so many emotions in people, whether it's because of the story that they've lived themselves or because of the stories that they know that are being lived by those that they care about and love. And none of these things bring out the best in you. The cost that it'll have to damaging relationships and memories and all of those things. This is a deeply, deeply problematic and desperately sad face that is not as it should be. These are not conversations that we should be having. And to fail to acknowledge that misses the point. But to try and eradicate it and say, well, we don't have to live like this. This shouldn't be our story, so we're going to fix it, fails to recognize actually what it means to live in a broken and messed up world where we don't live as it should be. And one day, and in a new heaven and a new earth will come, and there will be a time of no more pain, no more suffering. Every tear will be wiped from their eyes. We don't live in that yet. And so we must always acknowledge the cost of being present. Absolutely.
And we've said it before about the lens, it merges. These are not very distinct categories, because you can see immediately that presence, for me, I can feel it. It's taking me to participation in a sense, because I'm already thinking to be present is to also participate at a very localized level, because every human life has an impact on the lives of those around them. And these two conversations take us right to kind of pivot points on that power, purpose, freedom questions. If a life is seen to have no purpose, and who decrees that, and that whole conversation, but who then also has the freedom and the power to end it? And a lot of these conversations are about power and freedom to redefine or end a life without purpose, or to declare who has purpose and who doesn't in these moments. So that's probably why they come. Yeah, for us sitting within that participation lens, that those are the questions that really come to mind really quickly.
And it's worth saying that we came up with the word participation because of this very storyline, and was largely influenced by an interview that we did a few years ago on this podcast with Sarah Williams, who was talking about the pregnancy that she had. Nice little book plug there. What's the name of the book?
The Shaming of the Strong. That was just for the YouTube viewers. The Challenge of an Unborn Life.
So Sarah was pregnant with a baby girl who was diagnosed in the womb as being non-viable. In other words, she would not survive once she was born. There was no purpose to her life. So it's safe to say that up until that point, a lot of people had assumed that the being human lens would include the word in its primacy, purpose. A lot of people talk about being human as meaning and purpose. And yet the participation of Sarah's daughter in her life, the impact that she had, wasn't purposeful, but it was nevertheless impactful. She participated, she took part, she made a difference. And to ignore that or to diminish that because she was not going to have a purpose-filled life in front of her is to ignore a part of her story. And so what we wanted to do with the Being Human lens was to make sure that we carried the truth that human lives are participatory. They may not necessarily always be as purposeful as we may want or desire. That doesn't make them any less human. And so I think for me, that's the crux of this conversation, is to be human, does it necessitate purpose? And if it doesn't, what does that do to our sense of humanity?
Yeah, and Paul and Sarah wrestle as very powerful individuals in the sense of highly educated, good jobs. Paul at that stage was an economist, Oxford educated. Sarah was an Oxford prof. And they said the pressure they came under from the medical professionals about what was just presumed as the new normal, you will obviously end this pregnancy. And they said, no, they didn't want to. And so, it was that's an invalid choice. They were so almost dismissive. No, you don't clearly understand. You have to. We're moving to that. And ultimately carrying was born and didn't survive very long. But Sarah wrote about those experiences, and I found it one of the most, I was on a floor in a bathroom in an apartment we lived in Canada at 3 a.m. finishing this book. I just couldn't stop reading it, having got to know them a little bit. So that's a very personal level of engagement, but actually very thoughtful, because they step back and analyze it right through to the kind of, well, the, going back to Danny and Prue again that we talked about at the start, they're wrestling with it and doing it in a very public way on a TV show, but also how do we disagree well and have some of these conversations and talk about it well? Karen Swallow-Pryor, a friend of the show, has written very publicly that she attended lots of pro-life rallies. She was very engaged in that space, that she was passionate about it, but she's also written a lot about it. She's very thoughtful about it, and she engages as a real campaigner, but somebody with a lot of integrity who's written and written really articulately about it. So lots of different ways in which we engage, because these are very live in the UK right now. There are a series of amendments and bills coming through, and it's also contradictory. So the abortion one, for example, right now, it's a criminal justice bill. Dear knows when you'll listen to this and where it'll be in its journey, because it's been bouncing around for a long time. But there's one measure wanting to reduce the abortion limit from 24 weeks down to 22 weeks. There's another measure wanting to get rid of the exemption, if you like, at the minute for those with disabilities, because that seems to us to be an obvious example of discrimination. So somebody's proposing that. There are a number of others who want to decriminalize it entirely and say you can have abortion basically at any stage, and variations on that decrim, what that means, but fundamentally mean no charging and in a sense a change in the law to allow abortion at any time for any reason right up to birth. So massive changes and conversations, and these are highly conflicted conversations when they tend to happen. So just even engaging well is tricky.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest thing I've noticed, just going circling almost back to where you asked me earlier about connection. The ability to participate well into these conversations are deeply challenging. How to be heard, how to nuance, how to articulate, how to sympathize, how to empathize, all of those challenges when we participate, exercise our freedom, our power, and our purpose in this space can be massively difficult, which is why we want to use the Being Human lens. Tell me about how this affects your sense of dignity or your identity or questions around equality. Tell me how this affects you and those around you. How does this affect your body and your place in the world? How do you interact with this? All of these questions help us engage and participate in these conversations around beginning and end of life, which leads us straight seamlessly into practicing and inhabiting a better story. Practices, Peter, what are your suggestions as we explore these conversations further?
Well, regular listeners will be somewhat surprised by the irony. I'm going with hospitality. I'm claiming it before you do.
Fine. Rude.
In one sense, it's so obvious that we have to do that. This is the costly part of it. We have to be hospitable. That might look like adoption and fostering, and our wonderful friends at Home for Good and others who are leading the way and helping the church to do that. Like, how are we hospitable and bringing people in? It might be respite care in terms of the fostering. It might be opening our homes for those who are wrestling. And I think it's Safe Families and others who do this, bringing in of a family unit in a very difficult moment, often a single parent and a child who need help and support of a wider family. As a church community, it might be that you're in a stage of life where it's not possible to do the adoption thing, but you're journeying with somebody, being an extra kind of grandparent or uncle, and in inverted commas, you're not officially the uncle or grandparent, but you're the extra voice helping in that conversation, or an extra voice into it. And it's costly when it comes to the elderly within our community. It's going to see them, it's going to visit them, it's going, if it's our own parents, like they could be living with us with them, finding different ways of doing that. Way more intergenerational approaches to how we do life together. All of that is varying forms of hospitality, and it costs us, but it's incredible what it sows back into us as well.
We'll pop some of those organizations and some links into the show notes, so that if you would like to find out more about Home for Good, about Safe Families, all of those sort of things, we'll put those links in the show notes. I think for me, intercession is a key one. How do we pray into some of these spaces, because they get pretty contested and pretty dark pretty fast? What does offering hope in hopeless places look like? And how do we stand that gap? So intercession and prayer. But I'd also wonder whether or not actually a little bit of an examine practice. So the examine is literally the prayer of noticing and paying attention, of going through your day, running through your conversations, remembering who you've met, and just asking God's Spirit to point out and help you become attentive to some of the storylines and some of the interactions that you may have had, because our intercession is going to be fueled by what we notice and what we pay attention to. So maybe a bit of examine would be there.
Yeah, and I just want to, on the intercession, I also think there is, I mean, this for some and for people, it's a systemic thing. So the intercession is like, this is, again, I want to be really careful. I get these are really contested topics, but these are, it's not against flesh and blood. These are principalities and powers. The framing, the language, what we are doing, it is ultimately a culture of death in its various ways. And we are people of life and hope. And so it's pretty substantive stuff. And I think gratitude, the final one, we talk about gratitude and a spirit of forgiveness. When we, again, see what we have in life, see the things that we have been given, the gift of life and the gift to be able to be hospitable to others, examining our own spaces can really help reframe our own view towards the end of life and the beginning of life in some of those conversations, but also help us, I think, the spirit of forgiveness that is necessary in this. Like, we have all messed up. We have all done stuff that falls short. It's very easy sometimes to say, well, there's a problem with this bit over here, and I'm going to point that out. But also, there's a huge amount of forgiveness needed in this space. We are all carrying scars and markings around some of these, again, intergenerational things that can pass down through. It might be us, it might be generations before that we're unaware of some of the challenges that people have faced around this. So the ability to forgive ourselves, to forgive others in these conversations, I think is huge. There needs to be a space for that mercy and forgiveness, because sometimes these can appear very harsh conversations where it's very black and white. And if you've transgressed, you're wrong. And actually, a lot of people are carrying guilt and pain around these conversations. And we need to absolutely acknowledge that and create spaces for the conversations around that. Recognizing people listening to this right now will be carrying some of those things, as is often the case in these conversations. So we're not naive to that. It's really hard to understand how to pass to that. We just want to acknowledge that as part of what we do here.
Yeah, absolutely. None of us know the burdens that each other are carrying or the condemnation that we might be feeling. But we have to remember that in all of it, Jesus' death overcomes it all. And in him and through him, there is forgiveness for everything, both in yourself and for others. So, on that cheerful note, grace and peace to you all. Do remember to get in touch with us if you have any questions or comments. We will be back next time with another episode to explore the Being Human lens with. In the meantime, please like, rate, and subscribe to us on any platform that you can find us on. Until next time, take care and God bless.